to Mind Crime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss, was King Jong-il right about mathematics? Tim, can you give us the background to this somewhat strange episode title, please?
You know, one of like Michael Malice's excerpts from his book about the dear leader in North Korea, he brings up an example, an absurd story, which is the first time I heard of this, was when Kim Jong-il is in kindergarten. Now, this is probably 100% political propaganda. It may have never even happened. But when Kim Jong-il was in kindergarten, the teacher says 1 + 1 = 2. And Kim Jong-il raises his hand and says, no, it's not. You have one drop of water and another drop of water. You actually have one big drop of water. So 1 + 1 = 2. Now again, this story probably never really happened, but who knows? I like the fact that they're just telling the story is just evidence that it's just total nightmare high in a state. But nonetheless, this is where another example where Orwell actually predicts something that comes true in real life. In a way. But as philosophically, is Kim Jong-il correct? So there's a few ways we go into this. Mathematics, again, I'm a lay person when it comes to mathematics. I never particularly liked mathematics or the actual mechanics of doing arithmetic when I was in school. But I do like the philosophy of mathematics in general. And as far as the philosophy of mathematics is concerned, this is what will be more of a discussion of there. So is Kim Jong-il right? Well, you sent me a while back an article about Herbert Spencer. And he had a very interesting discussion on the measurement systems. And it was on the metric and the imperial units and why you adopt the metric units. And that sort of led me to creating this idea of this episode here. Because, again, mathematics have always been an interesting topic. You know, people like Bertrand Russell have spent years talking about mathematics. Mathematics is oftentimes viewed as the queen or the king, so to speak, of like logic. It's like the high, you know, this is real, and so to speak. But if you think about mathematics, they're just in a way symbols behind things. And you and I actually met on a podcast, and I was going on a tangent about words and do they have meaning. And this is where I think, you know, the question of the debate over do numbers exist comes in. I think the same debate has to occur with math as well. Again, I'm a layman in that regard, but I don't think that's an argument against me discussing any of these topics. I think in this way, the math people and the science people sometimes function as a functional priesthood, where unless you have the certain credentials, it's sort of a credential racket in that way. But as back to the actual issue at hand, in this regard, I'm more of a fictionalist in this regard. And this was the point I made on the very first podcast we met together, live stream, a round table. And I was just saying, like, if everyone says that chair, which is four legs and place to sit on top, you know, that is a chair. But everyone, instead of saying that, thinks it means coffee cup. Now, in this alternate universe, if everyone wanted to say, chair, hand you a coffee cup, then in that universe, coffee cup means like a thing you sit on, and chair means a thing that you drink coffee out of. It's very hard even to say a concept like that. But this is actually something that gets discussed in Orwell, where you have the sort of obvious contradictions like black-white and double think and things like that. And thought crime, all these sort of, you know, obvious contradictions that you sort of work out. And this is Kim Jong-un's, this goes back to the Kim Jong-un story. We get one drop, whatever drop, one big drop. And this comes into the do numbers exist story, and this relates to the sort of Herbert Spencer. So as far as like the Herbert Spencer article to me was interesting because I've long like Nassim Taleb, thought that this sort of metric system was a kind of top-down imposed system. And the imperial units are more bottom-up, spontaneous. This also relates to Wittgenstein and Hayek. They have the same sort of, you know, the idea that, you know, this spontaneous order. You know, instead of having some scientists in some central area think up of some system, and this is where Spencer says, Herbert Spencer says, why not turn the days, why not change the number of days? Actually, Napoleon wanted to make a 10-day and change the number, you know, Or why not change how many seconds or an hour? Or, you know, change those units around. And actually 12, which is the imperial units, is actually much more useful. You can divide it by 6, 2, 3, and so forth. You can only divide 10, you can divide it by 10 times, but it's not as dividable up. There's not as many, I can't think of the word that goes in there. And he also discusses the Roman numeral system as well. And the Roman numeral system, in a way, is more philosophically intuitive. Because as he points out in the Roman Colosseum, that the doors, and the Roman systems at the time did not have the thing that makes it look even more confusing, which is the backwards notation, where they show 4 as V, what is V, and I next to the left. Instead, they just show 4 dots. In that regard, the Roman system is sort of philosophically extremely intuitive. It just sort of exists. And this goes back to the do numbers exist type debate. And the Romans don't really have a 0, from my understanding. That comes in the Arabic numeral, So, like, there's no such thing as 0 apples or 0 legions or 0, chairs. There could be 1 chair. You could have 1 legion or 1 soldier or 1 arch, but you can't have 0. That's like a, it's like a non-existence factor. But nonetheless, I do think, in a way, I do think the story of Kim Jong-il in his interesting piece of political propaganda from Orwell coming true. But nonetheless, I do think, in a way, and of course, we can fully discuss this freely, at least for now. Maybe in the future we won't be able to discuss this. Can fully discuss this, and I do think the existence of numbers, and it does relate to things like the comment we talked about, like economics, because economics, should have this sort of human action view. Although there's nothing opposed to sort of the fictionalist view there in my view, that says that they're just a useful thing. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with saying that, math is useful because we can build bridges and have exact, precise measurements. And this is where imperial units are perfectly useful. We got to the moon with using inches, feet, miles, and so forth. And actually, scientists in general do less measurements on an average basis than their average, construction worker, cleric, bookkeeper, and so forth, trader. And that's another interesting point that Spencer made up, that the people that use these, and actually that the some of the more top-down systems have all these problems that need to get resolved on the ground. in countries that, like Iceland, Israel, and a few others, I just know Iceland, Israel, because I've been there. One of the problems I found, and Egypt as well, one of the problems I found is that the currency systems are so high, like you can buy something costs like $2,000. Not that it costs $2,000 or 2,000 pounds or 2,000 euros. It costs only like 20. So in that regard, they have to develop they end up developing a notation to reduce it. It sort of functions like an abacus, and that's another thing. Once the Romans got over a certain number, Roman numerals do become cumbersome, but then they just use an abacus. So in that regard, the Roman system is extremely intuitive, extremely useful. This is a point that Taleb would make, Nassim Taleb's point. I think Nassim Taleb once joked that I cannot find the citation for this if anyone wants to go fishing for it, but it sounds like something he would say. I remember in a Q&A I can't find, but he said that the reason the Romans didn't last it so long is they couldn't do statistics. Because you look at Roman construction, in a way it's somewhat overbuilt in a way, and I think one of the reasons why it probably is because they had the kind of complicated math and that stuff that we could do in that regard. So I've rambled on here about what math. Again, I'm not an expert in that regard, but I do think it's an interesting topic, and I do think it relates to everyday life, and I do in general like using the imperialist system. I have learned, based on travel, to speak metric. When someone says something that's 10 kilometers away, intuitively I've learned what that means without having to actually convert it to miles. And the same way with Celsius. On both accounts, I do think in general that numbers might exist, but they're definitely useful. So with that, any comments on, you know, is Kim Jong-il right about math?
It's an interesting question. Again, I'm somewhat of a layman when it comes to maths, which doesn't mean, though, that either of us don't have anything of merit to say on the subject. I would tend to note that I know a couple of people did like maths degrees, and I don't believe they ever really did any philosophy of mathematics on the course. And if they did, it was very, very minimal. Which is consistent with most subjects these days that you're just taught, especially undergraduate. Well, this is just the way things are, and you learn it, and you're unlikely to look at, say, the history of mathematics, because that's interesting, the kind of controversies of the 20th century on the foundation of mathematics. If I remember correctly, you have the logists, you have the intuitives, intuitionists. The constructivist. There's a whole host of different mathematical schools, which I think start arising soon after, but not necessarily at the same time. You mentioned zero, which is interesting. Zero is allegedly defined properly now in set theory, is my understanding, which was developed by Georg Cantor, and is defined as the empty set, which I've always thought was sort of an erroneous definition, because if there's a set, surely it's something. It can't be nothing, otherwise it wouldn't be a set. Now, I imagine some mathematicians are going mental at this point. But, and interestingly as well, the set theory and zero and stuff is the thing that kind of leads into the work of Gödel and I can't remember the exact name of the theory, but basically shows that mathematics is ultimately always inconsistent, because you can't, or it's incomplete. It's Gödel's incompleteness theory, I think it is, because you can't fully prove everything because of relations of axioms. And I'm pretty sure this is a result of set theory from memory. So those are some rambling sort of backgrounds of philosophy of mathematics. The question arises, do numbers exist? The question is, well, what would numbers be if numbers did exist? It would seem to be the case that numbers, if they were to exist, would have to be non-physical if numbers really existed as such, as separate from objects. So really there you have to posit something like the Platonic realm of numbers, which exists sort of as a separate sort of non-physical entity, or you could say that they exist in the mind. Now, you could say that's fictional in a sense, although then that raises the question, though, does the intellect correspond to reality? And I think that's really where a lot of the debate as to whether numbers exist really sort of comes from, because if you were to take, say, a fictionalist view of numbers, now, this isn't always the case, but it seems to me the case that the fictionalist view of numbers would correlate very strongly with a view that, well, when you look at reality, well, there's no real intrinsic order within nature. It's sort of just imposed upon by the mind. And this is where numbers are kind of fictional in that sense. Now, contrast this with sort of an Aristotelian view, that you have substantial forms, things like trees, and the easiest way to think about it is living beings, which have sort of obvious demarcated beginnings and ends, and also things to some extent like rocks, like an individual rock. I'm not talking about aggregates here, like a pile of rocks or a pile of trees, or artifacts like televisions, which are made up of different sort of natural sort of substantial forms. These substantial forms exist in the Aristotelian view, and they are distinct from other things. And if they have their own sort of nature, and they share they share a genus with something else, well, then if you count that accurately as to what reality is, well, that number, which in a sense which is an abstraction from reality in your mind, actually corresponds to something which actually does exist. Now, I suppose you could make the claim, well, even if you were to take that view, you could say that well, all you could say is there are three trees, for example, and the number three represents the three trees and that sort of correct and true abstraction from reality. But I think it perfectly plausible then to say, well, we have the concept of three trees, then we could have the concept of three in general. And then we can use this elsewhere. And that's sort of an abstraction. So in that view, and that's what I'm minded towards, it's more of a idea that numbers don't exist, except that they are a real true they are an abstraction from the intellect of reality, which is true. Now, there is sort of a third position between sort of the Aristotelian view and the Platonic view, which is basically numbers exist in the mind of God. And this is the idea that numbers have always existed, or numbers exist, as it were, but it is concepts. But since they've always existed in sort of the mind of God, as it were, there's it has sort of like a real existence in a way that either the fictionalist or sort of the Aristotelian abstractive view doesn't have, but need not posit this odd realm of the numbers which somehow inform reality but have no causal power of any description. So that would be a sort of a brief overview of different ways you could treat the numbers. As I would say, I think I would take more of the Aristotelian or the Thomistic view of numbers. But I think the real question, though, back to King Jong Un's statement about do you have two raindrops or do you have a larger one, really goes back to a more, as in a sense, fundamental question, which is one of ancient Greek philosophy of the one and the many. Is it the case in reality that there is only one thing? Do we have monism? Is the existence of different objects or different people in the world merely an illusion, and is we're all one in a sense of the ultimate Brahman in if I get that correct in Hinduism, or is it the case that, well, everything is just separate and loose, there's just atoms floating in the void like the atomists? Although actually I think the atomists were monists in certain respects, but you say the true atomist position, all atoms are sort of unique and separate and there's nothing that really unites them. Although even the problem with that view is to say that, well, actually, if you have different fundamentally and unique atoms, well, you've got a kind of a way of distinguishing them. And that kind of implies some sort of consistent way of at least being able to recognize the reality. But either way, you have the problem with the one and the many. You know, when does one drop of water, when do you have two drops of water, when do you have a bigger drop of water? It's like a cloud. You have one cloud and then another cloud touches it. Do you have two clouds or do you have a bigger cloud? I mean, that's kind of a fundamental problem, and how you go about resolving that is not necessarily straightforward. What I would say, though, is the common sense view is to say that, well, that things do exist and they are part of, using an Aristotelian term, the same genus. There are different trees, but we know they're all part of the oak tree. And that seems to correspond to reality. It's not just really a mental category. What you were saying before about, you know, you could call 4-7 and 7-4 or reverse like that. Well, that's true. You could give different names to things. The question is, and the way I would approach it is, well, does that really correspond to what actually exists in reality? So those are sort of my sort of opening thoughts on mathematics and really the question it raises of the one and the many.
First of all, your point about math people not being taught the foundations of math is entirely correct. Math people today, in a way, are some of the least philosophically interesting people. Actually, Richard Dawkins himself has a very negative view of a certain philosophy from my understanding. John Gray has some just dialogues on Dawkins, and he finds that a lot of these sort of new atheist math type people are kind of stuck up and sort of ignorant of the foundations of the things. And one of the problems of foundation things is Platonism, mathematical Platonism, is almost a religious position, and arguably it is a religious position. I mean, most historical, you know, the Pascals and the Newtons, they were all deeply embedded in Christian societies, and they had sort of a Christian Aristotelian Platonist type. Now, there's slight differences between all three, of course. And of course, Trueheart would say wretched Aristotle, but nonetheless, you know, the idea that numbers work and numbers sort of you can describes reality. He himself says that there's kind of an order to reality, which then we get in the dispute that like David Berlinski and would make, you know, if numbers describe the world so perfectly. I think Roger Penrose, is a good Christian mathematician. It's a different guy. But if numbers are so, if numbers describe the reality so well, what exactly are they? Now, but these are questions that the formal math people, the degrees, are uninterested and actually sort of have a blind spot, which is one of the reasons why I want to do this episode in a way as well. Your point about the cloud is quite interesting, but let me circle back. I do think it's not a mere translation problem. Let me gather my thoughts here. Zwei is two in German. Two is in English. Deux, I think that's French. Uno, dos. Dos, zwei, and all those words. They all point to the same thing. Two. Or what the Roman numerals would have, two dash marks. They all point to the same thing. So it's not a mere translation problem. That's not what the discussion is necessarily about. Although certain languages don't have all the words for all the concepts. I think in the Weindark Sea, Prime Minister Gladstone pointed out, like in the 1800s. This is where I heard from Taleb that the Greeks had no word for blue. So you had the Weindark Sea. Now, does blue exist? Well, in a way, blue exists. The color blue exists. But then again, colors are on a spectrum. And this goes back to sort of the Kim Jong-un thing about the clouds. One cloud, two clouds. Is that just a bigger cloud? But nonetheless, the Zwei and two, they're basically the same thing. Two and Zwei, they all mean the same thing. Man and der Mann is man in German. That's not the mistake there. Although there are translation problems. Umberto Eco has a great lecture on translation issues. And one of the problems that Umberto Eco points out is languages drift. And because languages drift, so if you're translating, if you're translating Shakespeare, which wrote in the 1600s, into English, into Italian, do you translate it into modern day Italian or old Italian? And do you take the modern English or the old English? Because English drifts. Because there is a point in which in the past where languages might be harder to understand today. And same way about there's a lot of slang. There's a lot of expressions that don't exactly line up anymore, and so forth, or they actually get even reversed. And this doesn't even get into technical problems. Like, we could spend hours debating on what the word liberal means. You could spend hours debating, how does Nancy Pelosi and Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine all, in a way, consider themselves one word? I mean, how would Umberto Eco translate political books? That's a great problem. I don't have any answer, but I don't think it's a translation problem in that regard. In all those languages, two means roughly the same idea. There's no drift. Now, one of the jokes Umberto Eco made was actually, and this relates back to his, how do you write? Well, in Hebrew, you write left to right. So there is also other problems. So writing systems can, in a way, change. And numbering systems have the same thing, might change the way you see things. But I think numbers, in a way, are much closer to being unified than language, as in the spoken form. Because you can sort of Greek mathematics look roughly the same. Although interestingly, Greek mathematics is more of philosophy. And this is another point I think that Spencer made, the Greeks just did all their math basically on their heads, without numbers. They just sort of thought about things. Now this is sort of a parody of it, but they just sort of like, they take, they had these the sort of these, I can't think of the term to just how they would draw their circles, so to speak. But if you go out measuring circles, of course, so the classic example of triangles, you'll never find a perfect circle or perfect triangle. So do triangles or circles exist? Not really in reality. And this circles back to my earlier problem I brought up. I think this is totally blind to all mathematics, and I think it's a purposeful blind spot in a way. It's something that they can't really get around. So I don't so with it. I don't think it's a translation problem, as I discussed. I think they all sort of point to the same things, and in this regard, I think it's fairly sound. We're not talking about any drift or expressions or complicated expressions. But do you think it's somewhat of purposely a blind spot? And do you have any further comments on those, Swithin?
So to the point on the foundations of mathematics, I'd entirely agree. It's true of almost all subjects, especially undergraduate level. It was the same in economics. You don't do any foundations of economics, really, or any of the history of economic thought, anything approaching that. I think my brother did do some in of history of astronomy when he did his theoretical physics degree, but it's quite rare, and they did have a module like that for economics at my university at Cardiff, but then they got rid of it because a lecturer left. They called it economic thought methodology. So this is something consistent, not just confined to maths, which is I think very prevalent, especially undergraduate level. It seems to be the case these days that they just think, well, undergraduates are just to learn stuff we tell them, as opposed to actually thinking. But this goes back to what we discussed in previous episodes on what's actually the current telos, not what should be, what it is at universities. And it's just a case of being rubber stamped by an official institution to say to employers, look, I am better than other people. Pay me money. You know, that's what it's there for. And also universities as well, as an aside, they're just there to publish. I'm not exactly sure what their funding model are specifically, but it seems at least these days you just got to publish. And that's not conducive to producing original or interesting work. It's just a case of, well, you know, let's just continue to plow through the current paradigm we have and what things haven't been covered within it, just so you can fill up your CV, as it were. So, yeah, that is certainly a problem. Not looking at the foundations of mathematics. Now, to my previous point, which you interpreted as saying that, well, different sort of civilizations or whatever, I implied that it was just sort of a translation problem rather than a substantive problem, a substantive difference in the approach to mathematics. I don't think I would argue there would never be any substantive approach. I just think a lot of what's claimed to be differences is actually translational. So, I mean, the Greeks didn't have a word for blue. Now, does that mean they didn't recognize blue? It was dark wine, I think it was. The dark wine was the term. I suppose you could take the claim that they didn't understand what blue was, but I think that unlikely. Now, when it comes to numbers, that's slightly different. I do think there's a substantive difference between a civilization that recognizes zero as a number in a sense, because that clearly gives you access to do lots of other maths that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So I wouldn't say that there can't be any substantive differences. The reason I was coming at it in that way is that certain people who like to claim that, I don't know if anyone heard this term, but like paraconsistent maths or there's this other maths which is sort of different and sort of, contradictory. Or this shows that your maths isn't just the one maths. And it's like, well, either one's right or one's wrong in almost all circumstances for that. So that's the why I was approached. But yeah, certainly zero, I think, gives you a substantive difference in what you can do. Infinity is an interesting one as well. Now, that does let you do more things. The question with infinity, whether it makes kind of any sense. Well, I mean, I suppose zero and infinity do make sense. Zero is, well, I did have something and now I don't. Okay, fine. That's zero in a sense. And infinity is, well, you just keep going. Again, that's cogent. The issue is when you try and treat, as I've mentioned before, zero as like an absolute platonic number, and then an infinity which is completed, which is, as I say, that goes to Cantor, who set theory in the late 19th century, which again just is, at least on the surface, is an absurd concept. Yeah, there can be substantive, but there's also, you could argue, in a sense, a pragmatic difference. There's various civilizations which have like really, really fine-grained distinctions between certain types of snakes, and they give them different names, whereas we just say it's a snake. But for their practical purpose, because they can get killed by them quite regularly, or they have a lot of more intimate relations with snakes than we do in the West, and so it would make sense then that you would have more fine-grained distinctions than you would have elsewhere. So I suppose you could have an analogous approach, say in maths, but I would say ultimately it would be consistent. It wouldn't be, if it was correct maths, as it were, it wouldn't be contradictory. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense in a way. But I do think that math in some ways is a kind of Platonic religion, especially for the people who treat it as such. Now, I'm fine with religions, by the way. I'm not against it. But I do think the actual underpinnings of math, kind of ethereal, when you see the physics people discuss math, they just say that these numbers just exist in these equations full of numbers or seeming variables. They just sort of exist. And I had the same experience with political science. They just sort of just treat the methodology as a sort of black box. I think that's the same treatment that math gets, just a kind of black box. You're not really allowed to look behind the curtain, so to speak. So in that regard, what the people commonly classify as postmodernist, and actually vaguely might be considered a right-wing postmodernist, you just look underneath the sort of black box that people discuss the sort of math. I think zero is an interesting concept as well, because as a kid, I always... negative numbers always screwed me up, and I think the reason they screw me up is technically negative numbers are distance between zero. They're not like true per se opposites. So it's like on a number line. So you have to sort of have the rabbit has to go down the hole too. Zero to one, one to two. That's actually distance from zero. So when I learned about the Roman numerals and not having zero, I've always found that fairly interesting. As far as the power consistent thing. I'm neither here nor there. In some ways that's above my pay grade, and in some ways it's just out. I have no actual interest in it. A lot of people criticize, for example, a lot of people will criticize the flat earthers. For example, you can get away with, and you can travel most everywhere using fairly effective flat earth maps. You can travel the Atlantic. You can travel the Pacific. The only trouble is around Antarctica. If you take the sort of disc model that the flat earthers have, which again, there's a lot of epicycles in it. But I think a similar analogy exists for math. Useful math that's good enough is just as good, is in most circumstances just as good as more rigid math, which relates to the sort of dispute between centigrade meters and imperial units. We'll say the imperial units are kind of asinine and arbitrary. Well, then again, arguably the centigrade and meters are equally asinine. And then that goes back to use. Why do physicists and so forth do use math? Why do mathematicians use math? And then this bleeds into what I would argue is a why question, which they're completely unable answer outside of, well, we get paid to by a university to do so. There's sort of explicit purpose, sort of crass reasoning why they don't answer these questions. But even then, but those are my general thoughts regarding math. If you want to comment on that, Swithin, and then maybe we'll start wrapping it up.
Oh, yeah. I do think that maths, in a sense, is a religion. I believe Pythagoras was a bit of a mystic and worshipped numbers. He was kind of like a more practicing Platonist, although I'm not entirely sure he had necessarily the same views as Plato did over numbers. But yeah, they are certainly there's certainly definitely a relation there. And yes, I do think we've how should we say, particularly you could call advanced maths. It is somewhat lacks solid foundations, shall we say, maybe the best way of describing it. Physicists seem to be very much enamored with them. Although the thing is, physicists have sort of, because you've got rid of any sort of notion of realism in science to a large extent, although it is coming back, in sort of physics, it's all about the predictive modeling, and then it's just all about the maths. And it's like, well, I'm pretty sure it's about the physics rather than the maths. But my understanding is that they're very much concerned about just same with economics to some extent. You know, it's mathematical modeling, and so therefore you just have to have a high regard for the math. Otherwise, the approach makes no sense. Oh yeah, imperial and metric units. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, you could say my position is somewhat of an extreme position, which I like aesthetically, is that I would take the view that, yes, maths is consistent and it should be rigorous and it should be logical. However, when we come to measurements, in sort of empirical measurements, well, you know, as long as they're accurate, as in they're repeatable and you know what they are every time, well, then a priori, there's no reason necessarily to use one over another. Given the fact that you're going to be measuring for particular purposes, and this just happens to be the case that historically, no, at least in Western Europe, I don't know what about the measurement systems in other countries. That's interesting. I never really thought about it. They've used the imperial system. It's only since the French Revolution where governments have decided, no, we should use this logical, rigorous system. Which is another sense to point out, you know, it isn't necessarily logical or rigorous in the way which they claim. You know, as we said before, you know, it's divisible only by like 5 and 2. The factors are only 5 and 2. 12, you can divide by 4 and 3. Also, there's a question of, you know, with the metric system is you've created a measurement system, then you try to get the world to conform to it rather than going out into the world and going, well, what is the world like? Let's measure it. You know, the 360 degrees in a circle, the 365 days in a year, the 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day. You know, this isn't all round numbers, but these are numbers which reflect reality. And that's really what Herbert Spencer's position was. So I think there's definitely a difference between sort of the measurements that you would use and sort of the foundations of measurements that you do use. Oh, yeah, on negative numbers. Yeah, negative numbers are weird, and that's... I've taught lots of people who aren't very good at maths at that, and they're very bad at negative numbers because they don't really make a huge amount of sense. And as you said, the best way to think about it is one of position. How do you have negative numbers? Oh, well, you are going backwards effectively from a point. That's what negative means. Otherwise, like, how can something be negative and be positive, as in it exists in the sense it's positive and therefore be negative? It's like, well, it can't. And another way I'd explain negative is like an overdraft. You know, you've got minus £1,000 in the bank. What does that mean? Well, it means you owe somebody owe the bank £1,000. So yeah, there are lots of errors you can make with minuses. And with Fahrenheit, I did a test. I thought, well, what's zero Fahrenheit? And it's actually like minus 18 degrees C. And unless you're in Canada, or probably Russia, I don't think you're ever going to get to minus 18 particularly often. So actually going down to zero Fahrenheit is kind of like, well, rare. And, you know, it's actually quite useful when you're always in a positive number. Now, there's also more fine gradations. A degree, I think, is like 1.8 Fahrenheit. So each Fahrenheit is somewhat more accurate in its measurement. And this is someone who's not a Fahrenheit native. I'm a Celsius native. In England, when I was growing up, we had an odd thing, whereas I was used to imperial in everything apart from temperature, which I never was. I knew metric as well. But we'd always do temperature in Celsius. And obviously in England we would have miles as well, so we always had that as imperial. Tim.
So my final question to answer the starting question of the episode is Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-un right about math? And I'd say maybe. I say maybe. Although in this regard, Kim Jong Il was very much wrong in the sense that, you know, if you want to use a useful system, you're not allowed to use a useful system. You have to use the state system. And actually, one of the reasons why the Phoenicians developed standardized math, standardized units of language, I think because the alphabet origin is from this, is so they could collect taxes. It's much easier to have taxes when everyone has the same units and measurement systems. It's much harder. And that's why I think one of the reasons why the European Union be even possible without the metric system? Probably not. Because then, I mean, having a leader, the French use one system, the Italians use another. The same way in the United States, those standards, weights, and measurement. Now, of course, the criticism is, well, then locals could defraud them with different things. Well, that's true, but then the taxman could just defraud them as well. A lot of standardization has nothing to do with scientific necessity. It has to do with the state wanting to better control its population. So I actually argue that having local measurement system is a kind of resistance. And actually, in Canada, it's interesting. Canada has a sort of two-way fight between imperial and metric. I was once on with some Canadians there. They said, "What's the temperature?" And they said, "Well, don't you use Celsius?" And they say, "No, we still stick. We privately use Fahrenheit," which I found was an interesting comment. But nonetheless, Kim Jong Un may be right about math. But then again, this is where actually physicist people are just much in the postmodernist camp, where it's just math becomes a kind of religion for them. And again, I'm not against religions, but this kind of religion gets imposed on them. As I say with my comments on the flat Earth view, you can get between England and, Columbus still, I'm not exactly sure what Columbus's private views on the Earth say, but he still managed to sail the ocean blue. A lot of these guys, you can still do a lot of sailing. So I think in that regard, math is useful up to a point. And once the model gets into this sort of ethereal realm, it is just sort of ethereal. So those maybe would be my answer to the episode's title. So any final comments? And then enjoyed discussing with you.
Not really, just to reiterate that I think one of the big questions when it comes to maths is, with back to King John Eel's point, is the one and the many, what actually exists in reality, and then how do we map maths onto it. I think that's the interesting one. It's like, would you have a water drop and goes to another one? Is that a bigger one, or do you have two? It's like, well that kind of depends on sort of like composition and kind of unity in reality. And I would also say, though, whilst mentioning that, if you're doing a measurement system, you should make it as sort of practical as possible, because that's what the purpose of measurement is. I'd just now like to thank everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this, please subscribe to us on YouTube and Podbean, and share it with your friends and family. And if you'd like to contact the show for any reason, any ideas or any comments you'd like to make, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.